And welcome to the program. You are listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO, in Portland, Oregon, USA. My name is Andrew Geller, and today we are going to be taking a look at yet another questionable constitutional practice of the Bush administration. Today we're going to be looking at the state secrets privilege. It is a legal practice whereby the state is able to, with really nothing other than just saying that it could affect national security, to prohibit the release of any information often used to quash whistleblower and other lawsuits where embarrassment and or negligence, or worse, could be involved. Here today to help me flesh this issue out, I have William Weaver. He is an associate professor of political science at the University of Texas at El Paso. And good morning to you.
Good morning.
And also on the line is Michael Avery. He's a law professor and the director of the, is that really Macaronis?
It's the Macaronis Civil Litigation Concentration.
Okay, thank you, and welcome to you. I hadn't thought about how I was going to say that word. Michael has been involved in a lawsuit that the Center for Constitutional Rights has brought against the Bush administration, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later on. But I'm going to start out here with Bill, who is one of the few people, as far as I've been able to read, who's kind of studied the state secrets privilege from an academic perspective, and some people may have seen there's been a bit of press about this issue recently. There's been several lawsuits that have been quashed in the past few years in a trend promoted by the Bush administration strongly. But I want to start out with where this idea came from in the U.S. in particular. You don't need to talk about Britain if you don't want. Can you tell us a little about the origins of the state secrets privilege, please?
Sure, but I think it is important to talk just briefly about Britain. It came from, originated in crown prerogatives, which were prerogative rights of the king or queen of England to do things outside of the law. And the idea was that the crown could be trusted with the public good, and they talk about trust lots of times in cases and discussions. And it became a really a problem. Right during the 1620s, where the privilege began in discussion in Parliament, and it began to be questioned and that sort of thing. But the courts, pretty much in Great Britain, adopted the king's position wholesale, because the courts in Great Britain, of course, are generally an arm of the executive branch. And the United States did not have any experience with the privilege at all. You know, there is a claim that in a case by Aaron Burr that the privilege was utilized, but in fact, a careful reading of that shows that it was not utilized in that case. And so the privilege really has no history in the United States. And along comes this case in the 1950s of a crashed Air Force plane, and the victims, right, who died in the crash and their families sued for monetary damage, the U.S. government, saying that it was negligently caused. Turns out that happens to be true. But the government asserted this privilege, right, the state secrets privilege, saying that because any information we disclosed would jeopardize national security, then we shouldn't have to give any of this information to the litigants. And the district court said, forget it. If you want to do that, that's fine, but you lose the case. And that was upheld on appeal at the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. And it got to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court in 1953, when it got this case, was casting around because there was no history for this privilege in the United States to speak of. And so they seized on a case in Great Britain, a case called Duncan versus Camel Laird, where pretty much the law lords in Great Britain said, whenever the crown doesn't want to release information on the basis of national security, it doesn't have to. And the Supreme Court said, aha, you know, here we go. This is a great precedent for us, too. It works just as well. And they adopted this precedent kind of wholesale without any real discussion. The case is only five pages long. And they imported with that a culture, which is not our culture, and they imported with that a form of government, which is not our form of government. We don't have any trust in a crown because we don't have a crown. You know, the whole Constitution is built around a lack of trust. So it's amazing to me that this privilege would be adopted in this way from Great Britain with really not much as an afterthought by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, and in an article written by Barry Siegel in April 2004 in the Los Angeles Times, it's a huge multi-part article that tells the story of this case, the U.S. versus Reynolds. And referenced therein, I couldn't exactly find the reference at the moment, but, you know, there's a very strong hint of knowingly deceptive testimony by an Air Force or, yeah, I guess it was an Air Force general in the case. And that was a key issue in the court saying, right, you don't have to release this if you don't think you should.
It turns out Barry was definitely onto something. You know, I've talked to Barry about this on several occasions, but a person named Lewis Fisher, who is at the Library of Congress, a very prestigious writer, has written a book which is coming out this fall called In the Name of National Security. And in that book, it's all about the Reynolds decision, and he details how the government just lied. The privilege is born from a lie. There was never any national security issues at stake at all in the Reynolds case. It was simply an attempt by the government, successful in the end, to create a new privilege that would give extraordinary power to the executive branch, and it worked.
Okay, now, it was established in 1953. It was used kind of regularly, but not all that frequently for, 25 years or so?
It arose four times in the 23 years following Reynolds in reported cases.
And just briefly, can you tell us the type of, just is there a general reason or type of case? Were they whistleblower issues? Was it potential negligence or government culpability for something?
This represents a fundamental change in the use of the privilege. In the early days, the privilege was a bottom-up kind of enterprise. In other words, people who really dealt with classified information, the people who were in the agencies who had an idea of what should be protected, what really couldn't be made public, were the ones who drove the decisions. They would go to the agency head and say, look, we really can't release this information. And so it was in a variety of cases, but it was driven from the bottom up. And what's happened under the Bush administration especially, you know, you saw a great increase in the use of the privilege after Jimmy Carter. But in the Bush administration, this administration, Bush 2 especially, it's a top-down driven model. In other words, the use of the privilege isn't to protect national security for national security's sake. The use of the privilege is a political device to protect the president from embarrassment. It's a fundamental change in the use of the privilege, and it is a perversion of what the privilege was meant to be.
Let me actually quote from U.S. v. Reynolds from 1953, quote, because it is so powerful and can trample legitimate claims against the government, the state secret's privilege is not to be lightly invoked. Now, with that as a segue, I want to bring Michael in here to begin discussing a case that he's been involved with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. And this case was actually recently thrown out as a result of the invocation of the state secrets privilege. This has to do with the warrantless National Security Agency wiretapping. And that's something we've covered here on the program before. People can look for previous programs about that. So we're not going to go into the background of what that issue is about. It's been fairly in the press for many months now. Can you tell us a little bit what the specific lawsuit that CCR filed was seeking?
First, let me clear up one thing. You've thrown out our case a little prematurely.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
the court hasn't ruled on the motions yet.
Okay, a motion was made to have it be tossed.
Correct.
Okay.
And this is a case which was filed on behalf of lawyers at the Center for Constitutional Rights. I'm one of the lawyers representing them. I'm doing that on behalf of the National Lawyers Guild, because I'm the president of the National Lawyers Guild, and the Guild wanted to assist CCR in this case. CCR lawyers represent most of the people who are being held at Guantanamo Prison. And in that connection, they have to have many, many phone conversations with people in other countries who are either relatives or associates or people who know the prisoners, and they are concerned that given the description of the warrantless electronic surveillance that the president has authorized, they're concerned that their conversations, either with their clients or with their clients' relatives or witnesses, are being overheard by the government. So they filed a lawsuit against President Bush and against various officials of the National Security Agency to enjoin the president, to get a court order telling the president that he has to stop doing this electronic surveillance. And a week and a half ago, we received the government's initial response to our lawsuit, and that response was a motion asking the district judge to dismiss the case, throw the case out, on the grounds that the government can't defend what it's doing without revealing secret information. So they're coming to court and saying, we have a good reason for what we're doing, but we can't tell you what it is, and we certainly can't tell the plaintiffs what it is, and we can't put on the public record what it is. But trust us, it's a very good reason, and you should throw the case out. Now, in our case, our response to that is, well, it's clear from the public record, without getting into any secret information at all, it's clear from the public record that the president in this case is acting beyond the powers that he's been given by the Constitution and by Congress. The president has no power to engage in electronic surveillance of telephone conversations where one of the people is in fact in the United States, unless Congress passes a statute giving him that power. And Congress did pass such a statute, but it said that if he wants to use that power, he has to go to court and get a warrant and comply with the law. And what President Bush wants to do is ignore that law that Congress passed and just engage in surveillance when he and the NSA want to, without having to answer to anybody about it. And our view is that this is a major threat, that the government's response to our lawsuit in this case is a major threat to American constitutional democracy.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland, Oregon. That was Michael Avery. He's a law professor at Suffolk University in the Boston area. And also joining us this morning is William Weaver. He is a professor down at University of Texas, El Paso in the Political Science Department. And we're talking about the state secrets privilege. You can find out more about this topic with links to relevant documents at the People Rise Up page of the KBOO website, kboo.fm. Now, Michael, you are in the Boston area. I, in the course of pulling research for the program, saw a fascinating article from Sunday's Boston Globe.
Yes.
Good old Charlie Savage. He is on it. The American Bar Association voted unanimously Saturday to investigate whether George W. Bush has exceeded his constitutional authority in reserving the right to ignore more than 750 laws that have been enacted since he took office. Now, this has to relate to the presidential signing statement, and it's not exactly the same issue as state secrets privilege, but it's kind of the other side of the coin, or the other side of the 6 or 12-headed dice, whatever, however many times they need to have it described, their way of dealing with openness and secrecy and information.
Well, what's happening in the United States at present is that the president and his people are making just an enormous grab to increase the amount of power that the president has and that the executive department has. And what the signing statements are about is President Bush is in essence saying, when he signs a law, I'm going to issue a statement at the same time, and that statement is going to clarify what parts of this law I'm going to enforce and what parts of the law I'm going to feel free to ignore if I claim that there's some sort of national security or other constitutional reason why I have to ignore that law. And that goes along with an argument. This is all part of what people call the unitary executive theory of the presidency, it goes along with an argument that the president can interpret the Constitution. Of course, I agree with that. He has to try to follow the Constitution. But his argument is that the Supreme Court doesn't have any authority to make the final determination. And so people need to realize that what we're looking at is the president is coming close to saying that if the Supreme Court issues an order, he may not have to follow it. And if Congress passes a law, he may not have to follow that. And that he's really entitled to go in his merry way because he's the president. Well, and as Professor Weaver was so eloquently talking about before, this is precisely the reason that that the colonists created the Constitution they did, because they were sick of King George acting in that way, and they didn't want an American president to be able to act that way.
And let's bring Bill Weaver back into this here. Now, the CCR case is only one of, I think, six recent instances where the Bush administration has invoked the state secret privilege. I guess it's the first was against Sybil Edmonds. And as far as I can see, she's the only one who's had it invoked against her twice. Sybil's been on the show talking about one of the instances in which this was invoked against her. Can you tell us a little bit about the trend you see, Bill, in why it is the Bush administration has been so eager to invoke this privilege in judicial action?
I think Michael hit it right on the head when he said that this administration wants to press this theory of the presidency, which is known as the unitary theory of the executive, which is that the president of the United States, due to, in some degrees, changing exigencies because of technology and because the president could act with alacrity when Congress and the judiciary can't, you know, that the president has to be the first among equals, the one who really drives the country, the one who really makes the decisions for the public. And I think that that's a lot of what's behind it, with people like John Yoo and others who were advising the president. They've really pressed this very hard, and they've pressed it to an extent that has, you know, that we've really never seen before. I mean, even Abraham Lincoln, when he deviated from the Constitution, admitted that it was a deviation from the Constitution and that there would be a return as soon as possible. This president doesn't even admit that there's a deviation from the Constitution. But the privilege has been invoked by this president more than any other president in history. He's invoked it 19 times, which ties Ronald Reagan, but he also is threatening to invoke it next week in a case in Oregon. And it's clear that he is going to be, hands down, the most active secret president in the history of the United States. And, of course, if the presidency is opaque. And one thing that you have to understand is that the privilege is coextensive with all classified information. So one thing that hasn't been noted a lot is that the president has extended classification authority to agencies that never had it historically, such as the EPA, Health and Human Services, Department of Agriculture. So now those agencies can originally classify information as secret or top secret, and they therefore now have access to this privilege when they didn't have access to it before.
Next week, I'm imagining it's the Brandon Mayfield case here.
Right.
And so what we have now is a situation where people can, either acknowledged or unacknowledged, be detained for a length of time without charge, potentially tortured. And in the case Khalid al-Masri, this is a case pretty much like I just described. He was released. He was held for many months, tortured, released, never charged. And they basically admitted they had the wrong person all along. And now he's being told that he can't sue. This has been rather large news in Germany, where I guess some of this took place. You know, as Michael had brought up, there's this kind of struggle between Congress and the executive and the Supreme Court and the executive potentially. And it doesn't seem as though the Congress and the Supreme Court are able to realize that it could be in their best interest to somehow work together to counterweight the executive. This is a unique situation, as far as I can tell, in U.S. history. So what? How does that work when the executive can basically claim absolute power?
Well, it's not actually so unique. And
in this country?
Let me give you a couple of examples.
Okay.
Because this is a perennial problem, and one that that we haven't done a good job of solving. But when during World War II, when the United States relocated Japanese Americans into concentration camps, internment camps in the middle of the country, that was done on the basis of a report which was issued by General DeWitt, who was the head of the command zone that included the western part of the United States. And General DeWitt said that the presence of Japanese Americans in California raised a threat of espionage and sabotage. Now, as a matter of fact, the Department of Justice at the highest level had information that contradicted General DeWitt's conclusions. They knew that there were no threats of espionage or sabotage. Not a single Japanese American at any point during the war was prosecuted for espionage or sabotage of that sort. And yet, even though they had that information, they lied to the Supreme Court about it. They distorted their brief and the representations that they made to the Supreme Court to make it appear that they were in agreement with what General DeWitt was saying. And the Supreme Court made a decision in the case saying that national security required the relocation of Japanese Americans and that the court was in no position to second-guess the government in that regard. If we go forward to the Vietnam War, when the New York Times and the Washington Post were about to publish the Pentagon Papers, the government came forward and asked the courts to enjoin publication of those papers, saying that publishing those papers would be a national security risk and severely compromise the prosecution of the war. And the Supreme Court ruled against them in that instance, and the papers were published. And, of course, there was no fallout from the publication of those papers that compromised national security. So we have, historically, many, many, many of these examples of when the government has come to the courts or gone to Congress and said there's a danger that is so serious that we have to do something extraordinary and we have to keep it secret. And we know from this history that the government has a tendency to exaggerate, to make misrepresentations, sometimes to outright lie. And this national security excuse, this state secrets excuse, is so easy for them to invoke that the courts in Congress, most of the time in the past, Pentagon Papers case was an exception, most of the time in the past, they've rolled over and let the executive do this. And my question about the present time is, in a constitutional democracy, why should we have to wait 50 years for the truth to come out? We should be able to get at the truth now.
In a great op-ed piece from Tom Blanton, the director of the National Security Archive, about 2.5 weeks ago in the Los Angeles Times, he quotes Irwin Griswold, who was the U.S. Solicitor General that prosecuted the New York Times regarding the Pentagon Papers case in 1971. And he later confessed that there, in fact, was no national security damage from those papers. And he at the time said, quote, "It quickly becomes apparent to any person who has considerable experience with classified material that there is massive overclassification and that the principal concern of the classifiers is not with national security, but with governmental embarrassment of one sort or another," end quote. I would suggest that people go to the National Security Archive because they have a report out called Pseudo Secrets, which has to do, it's the first government-wide audit of classification policy regarding sensitive but non-classified material. It's fascinating information, relates directly to what we're talking about here, except that we're just about out of time. So, Michael, is there anything people can do to lend any support to the effort with the lawsuit, or is it just pretty much in the courts?
I think this is a problem that really is probably going to have to be solved politically rather than in a lawsuit, And what I've been urging people to do, this is a little leap from what we've been saying so far, but what I've been urging people to do is let the people who are running for Congress in your district know that you're not going to vote for them unless they tell you that they're prepared to bring a bill of impeachment against George W. Bush for violating the Constitution and violating the law. He has committed a five-year felony in connection with this surveillance, and I think that the House of Representatives should begin impeachment proceedings on that basis.
Bill Weaver, any last thoughts?
Nothing except that I would agree completely with what Professor Avery says. I think that he's George Bush is impeachable on a number of grounds.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the NSA activity itself is sufficient.
That will do it for us. William Weaver is a professor of political science at the University of Texas, El Paso, and has studied the state secrets privilege extensively. Michael Avery is a law professor at Suffolk University in Boston and director of the – oh, God, I can't do it again.
Just tell him I'm the president of the National Lawyers
Guild. Okay, he's also the president of the National Lawyers Guild. Thank you both very much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
I'd also encourage people to take a look at a new report that's out that I just found the other day. It's actually at the Cato Institute website, cato.org. It's called Power Surge, the Constitutional Record of George W. Bush, which seems as an appropriate out considering the talk of multiple grounds for impeachment there from Bill Weaver. If you have any questions or comments on anything you heard on today's program or any other show that I've done, feel free to send email to me at kboo@riseup.net. The People Rise Up page at the KBOO website, kboo.fm, will have links to both guests as well as information related to the state's secret privilege. Audio of this program is available online at open source audio from archive.org. Thank you very much for listening to the program today.